This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Mannix and Beck back. What up, Mr. Beck?
What up, Mannix? How are you, sir?
So, Howard, I know you wrote eloquently about your father in the New York Times just a couple of weeks back. My question for you, though, looking back on your relationship with your dad, did he ever tweet at your employer to fire you? The reference, of course, Marvin Bagley, who is the father of, or Coach Bagley, the father of Marvin Bagley, the player with the Sacramento Kings, tweeting out that the Sacramento Kings should trade Marvin Bagley. So did your dad ever do anything like that, Howard?
No, and I'm not sure if firing and trading are quite the same, but I guess that's the only analogy we have,
cousins.
Right? Yeah. No, I will say this, though. My dad was a Twitter lurker and was not a prolific tweeter. I think he just followed me and maybe, you know, some news organizations, whatever. And every so often, he would hit me with something, usually to tweak me. So, I'd make some, reference to something, music, like a song, and he would, make fun of me or whatever. He'd mock me on there. So, but nobody would have known that that was even him. So, he did not cross the kind of boundaries that Marvin Bagley's father, Marvin Bagley Jr., not to be confused with Marvin Bagley, the third. Mm-hmm. I was never put in that position, and I do not envy Marvin Bagley of the Kings for what his father, the position he put him in.
Is there any more Kings story than that? I mean, could that happen to anyone but Sacramento? I mean, not only does Marvin Bagley tweet, trade my son, then you have De'Aaron Fox, his father, saying, trade him. Like, you got dads getting involved on social media. Meanwhile, Luke Walton's sitting there being like, oh, God, this is starting already? Like, we can't give it, 6 weeks for us to collapse in the stand. I mean, you can't.
I think the obvious solution is that Bill Walton needs to weigh in.
Oh, God.
I mean, if we're going to get fathers of players, you know, sniping about the team and about each other possibly, might as well have the coach's father who, Bill Walton, I would listen on any topic anyway. I love hearing from Bill Walton. So by all means, if all the dads are going to get involved in roster construction and rotations and minutes and everything, why not bring Bill Walton into the mix too? I mean, you're right, Chris. On some level, this is a very Kings thing. But listen, Lonzo Ball was on the Lakers when LeVar was making a mess at times down there. So this could happen to anybody. I don't want to pile on the Kings. I think it's an unfortunate thing for a team that is young, that does have some upside potential, that did have a strong start to the season the first few games, and that has a new front office with Monty McNair and Wes Wilcox and other folks who are coming in trying to finally get this thing on track. And this is the first thing that happens in 2 weeks into the season. Is not even your players at fault, and granted Marvin Bagley's not playing well either, but to have something that is completely out of your control, families of your players now murkying the waters even more, that's the last thing you need as a young team with new front office leadership. It's you're just making it that much more difficult. And this is, look, none of us should ever tell anybody else how to run their families. I don't want to tell, Marvin Bagley Jr. what kind of father he should be or how best to advocate for his son. But I think it's objectively true that this just did not help matters at all. And it is not the most constructive way to straighten things out if you're concerned about his minutes or his role.
No, and I mean, I don't think Marvin Bagley handled it all that well either. I mean, he gets on a Zoom call and basically says, don't ask me about the only thing worth asking him about at that point. Don't say, hey, do you want to be traded? I mean, this reminds a little bit of the John Wall situation where you didn't have John Wall's family requesting the trade, but it went out there into the universe. And then Wall, when asked about it at a charity event, just offered no comments. I'm not going to to talk about that. Bagley, meanwhile, is, you know, going through another, you know, blah season to start the year. He hasn't lived up to the expectations that come with being the number two pick. He's always going to have the not Luka Doncic label attached to him for as long as he's in Sacramento. I mean, this doesn't seem like it's going to have a happy ending, Howard. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's too early to say it's unrecoverable, but something tells me this doesn't end well for Marvin Bagley and the Kings.
It's hard to imagine that it will. And you brought up a fair point here too. Like, it's not Marvin Bagley's fault that the Kings took him ahead of Luka Doncic. That's on the Kings, and it's on their previous front office led by Vlade Divac, who's of course no longer there, maybe in part because of that choice. But Bagley still has to live with the consequences anyway, because the fans are always going to say, man, think about who we could have had. And they've been, I think, fairly supportive. He's lucky, by the way, quick side note, just as James Harden was lucky or remains lucky, a lot of guys are lucky, that there are no fans in buildings right now, Chris. If there were fans in buildings, the consequences for some of these things, and again, not Marvin Bagley's fault that his father decided to tweet this, although Marvin Bagley's performance is, you know, in and of itself would draw some ire from fans. No fans in buildings means these guys are not having to deal with nearly the level of stress and blowback that they would in an ordinary season. So worth noting that. And look, Kings fans have been pretty supportive of him and patient, and he's been hurt over his first couple of years too. So it's not fair to Jet. Like, the potential for a really good player is still there. But, you know, now you worry that there's another distraction here, that his father has not just made things murky with the Kings, but his own performance on the court, I think, has taken a downturn even since those remarks became public. So, and who only, you know, how do you now, like, how do we even begin to think about what the dynamic between De'Aaron Fox, again, not his fault that his father decides to pop off, but De'Aaron Fox and Bagley on the court now, are they having to now sort out what their fathers are saying and how that affects, like, you don't need this when you're a young team that is presumably on the rise or at least trying to take those steps forward. So, look, this will probably pass, Chris, and it'll quiet down. But, you know, at some point, the Kings need to have the kind of professional environment where these kinds of things don't even become part of the equation. And sometimes that means having a relationship with the families, too, and trying to say, listen, we want to work with you and we want the best for your son, but we got to do things a certain way. And, you know, I hope they get it together, because I like that team. There is definite potential there to at least be a really fun and interesting team, and they don't need this.
Just when you thought the Kings were no longer the Kangs, this comes roaring up once again, reestablishing them as kind of a bleep show out there in Sacramento. All right, on this episode today, we're going to talk about James Harden, his future with the Rockets, and exactly what kind of teams should be interested in him. Steph Curry, is it possible the Warriors could consider trading Steph Curry? Michael Pina had an interesting piece on SI.com about that. The Phoenix Suns, off to a good start. How real is that? We'll talk a little bit about the Knicks. And has Jaylen Brown become too big to trade for the Boston Celtics? But Howard, I want to start with your piece this week on James Harden. That was a daily cover on Monday. And you took kind of a closer look at, you know, basically what James Harden wants out of the rest of his career and exactly what kind of situations he can fit into. Give me kind of the quick rundown of your what you wrote this week.
Yeah, no, like, the framework is this. He wants out. Okay, we all know he wants out. We know he's got a list of teams. We know that they have not been able to find the right deal yet. That's why he's still in Houston. But I don't think, Chris, that the question about James Harden is so much about where is he going to land. That's obviously important, and the balance of power in the NBA will tip as a result of an eventual deal. But to me, it's more about what does he want and what's he willing to do at this stage of his career. He's 31. He's been an MVP and a perennial MVP candidate. He's one of the greatest scorers we've ever seen. He's an incredible player. He has not been able to get to the finals. He has not won a championship yet, but he hasn't even been to the finals. And there are circumstances regarding that, right? Going up against a historic Warriors team year after year. Chris Paul's hamstring a couple of years back. There's always other parts of the picture we can draw into this. But I think at the core of it still is this. James Harden's the most ball-dominant player we have seen in a very long time, one of the most ball-dominant of all time. And I think that has, on some level, inhibited the Rockets' ability to break through. I think that it's inhibited the ability to incorporate other stars, whether it was Chris Paul or Russell Westbrook. I think it's inhibited the ability to even acquire or allure other people to play there with him. But forget the Rockets. Like, the Rockets are irrelevant. What he's done is irrelevant. I don't even want to dwell on whether we should let Harden off the hook for any of their failures or falling short. It's more about this, Chris. When he lands in Philadelphia to play with Joel Embiid, or when he lands in Brooklyn to play with Durant and Irving, or when he lands in Miami to play with Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo, wherever he ends up, is he going to insist on still being a 35 to 38% usage guy? Is he still going to want to dominate the ball and the offense to the extent that he always has? Because if he gets somewhere else, Chris, especially if he gets to one of his preferred destinations, it's going to mean pairing up with at least one, if not two, other all-stars. And those guys aren't going to want to just sit around watching Harden beat the ball into the ground. So the question I have is, what's he willing to do at this stage at 31, having gotten all the individual accolades possible, but not the ultimate prize? And I analogize it to the Celtics of 2007-08, talked to Ray Allen for the story. And it's about that sacrifice that Ray Allen, Paul Pierce, and Kevin Garnett made that enabled the Celtics to be better than the sum of their parts. It's one thing to have three Hall of Famers, but if they don't play in concert with each other and each take a step back, and serious steps back that they took, then you can't get there. And James Harden, if he does land with multiple other stars somewhere, that's going to be the first question. How do you make it work?
Yeah, I think the counter I would make to that is twofold. One, it was a lifetime ago. I get that. But every time I talk to people in Oklahoma City, I'm reminded of just how comfortable Harden was playing off of Durant and Westbrook. Again, it was a long time ago, and James Harden was a complimentary player back then. He's an MVP candidate last now, what, three, four-time NBA scoring champion. So things have changed significantly. But in that role, like, it's misleading for people to rewrite history. Not saying you do it, but like, some people rewrite history and say Harden wanted out of Oklahoma City because he wanted a bigger role. He didn't. He, you know, got out of Oklahoma City because they made the catastrophic mistake of not maxing him out and thinking that, you know, salary cap ramifications were more important than signing James Harden. If they had signed there, maybe the same things would have happened. Maybe he would have wanted to be an alpha somewhere else, but we don't know that to be true. The other side of it is too that, like, everything you say is right, but I can't fathom, like, James Harden saying, I want to go to Brooklyn and I want to be the same guy. Like, or I want to go to Brooklyn and I want to be the same guy, or any of these other possible places. Like, he's got to know that wherever he goes, things individually change dramatically. And I have to believe that his willingness to do that comes down to his clearly strong desire to play for a winner. I mean, he could stay in Houston, be James Harden, be part of a perennial playoff team, sign that extension, make $50 million plus per year in the last 2 years of a new deal, and become one of the most decorated individual players ever. I got to believe in James Harden's head, he's at least made the calculation that I'm going to have to take a step back with my individual success in order to have team success. I just got to believe, and maybe that's naive on my part. Maybe he's just a guy that says, like, look, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to be James Harden. But I can't fathom him thinking, like, I'm going to go to Miami, play with Jimmy Butler, but I'm going to be James Harden. I'm going to go reunite with Kevin Durant and Kyrie, but I'm going to be James Harden. I just can't see him, like, having that mindset, Howard.
You would hope not, Chris. And one of the reasons I thought the Celtics were an interesting analogy is because of the age factor, right? You get to your early 30s in the NBA, and if you've been a superstar, if you've gotten a lot of individual accolades, scoring titles, and an MVP in some cases, all NBA, whatever, like, that's when you finally have that moment where you go, all right, I've done all that stuff, but I don't have a ring. My career won't feel complete without it. What do I need to do to get it? And some guys will make that adjustment. And that's what Pierce and Ray Allen and Kevin Garnett did brilliantly. But not everybody does that. Like, Allen Iverson would never make the adjustment. It was tough for him in Denver with Carmelo. He gets flipped to Detroit, and eventually the Pistons decide, you know what, you'd be a great sixth man at this stage of your career. I'm not a sixth man. Eventually he's not a Piston anymore. Then he's a Grizzly. Grizzlies want to be a sixth man. I'm not a sixth man. Next thing you know, he's out of the NBA. And, you know, look, the late, great Kobe Bryant. Kobe was never going to be any other version of Kobe once he got to those late stages of his career. And that had consequences for the Lakers. We don't need to go down that path, but it did. And it's fine. Not everybody is willing to say, you know what, at a different stage in my career, I have to do things differently. And Kobe had won 5 titles. Like, Kobe could do whatever the hell he wants. James Harden has not won anything. And I think at this stage, again, 31 years old, this is the time when you say, all right, I've got some elite years left. Can I channel all of my skills, my considerable skills, in a different way? Because he'd be incredibly dangerous off the ball as well, or to play more of a Steph Curry kind of approach where you might be the primary ball handler, but you're not possessing the ball and using as many possessions in such a dramatic, dominant fashion. You give up the ball and wait for it to come back to you sometimes. Like, there's a lot more he could do, especially if he were with Durant and Kyrie Irving or on a Heat team with Jimmy Butler. Yeah, logically, Chris, you could say, as you did, why wouldn't he want to make those adjustments if it meant winning? But not everybody has the mindset that says, I can do it another way. Some people want to win it only on their own terms. And of the scouts I talked to, or executives I talked to for the story, that was the kind of overarching skepticism, was Harden wants to win it his way, just like Allen Iverson wanted to win it his way or no way. And but we don't know. We don't, right? Like, why does Harden want out of Houston? Well, presumably because he doesn't see a path to a championship anymore there. And, you know, I think that door had been closed for maybe longer than he did, but he's gotten to that point. He wanted to stay there forever. He told me that a year and a half ago. And now a year later, he's saying, no, I want out. That's fine. Things change. But if it's to win a championship, if the goal is to get somewhere else to win a championship, then I think it's almost a given that it should also entail curtailing his game on some level, that it's going to require fitting in with another star or multiple stars. And especially if it's a team like Brooklyn with other primary ball handlers, other guys who are high usage guys, I don't know how else it could work unless you're going to give a little. But I would just quickly point out before I finish here, last season, Harden's usage was still top 10 in the league at 36.3, and that was while playing alongside one of the other most ball-dominant players we've ever seen in Russell Westbrook. So if he wasn't going to give up more control for his friend since 10 years old, Russell Westbrook, then I don't know at what point he's willing to. And by the way, the sixth man of the year thing back in Oklahoma City, yes, it's ancient history. I don't even think it's relevant at this point.
All right, I mean, that's fair. Although, like, the difference with Harden and Iverson is that Harden has been that guy before, whereas Iverson came into the NBA and he was the alpha from jump. I mean, they eventually built that team around him in Philadelphia, so he knew nothing else. Harden at least has the framework and saw the success. I mean, when they went to the finals back in 2012 with that team. So maybe that sticks in his mind a little bit. I think it's impossible for him to be the guy you're talking about in Houston. Like, even if Houston went out and, like, acquired Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, Harden would say, this is my team. He goes somewhere else, and maybe there's a little bit more deferentialness, for lack of a better word on that one. But we'll see.
Deferentiality.
Deferentiality. We'll see. I think we're still a ways away from Harden getting that team.
Okay, but I would just note, and again, these guys, everybody's built different, and we should not hold anybody to any other standards, but Dwayne Wade did have LeBron come to his team in Miami, and after initially kind of like having those awkward moments of trying to figure out whose team it was or who has primary control, eventually Wade ceded to LeBron because that's what worked and it got them championships. And Steph Curry clearly, famously did the same in inviting Kevin Durant to the Warriors. So look, it can be done. And we do have recent examples of it. And I'm not saying that Harden can't or won't. I just, you know, the story was about will he? Is he willing to? And we don't know, because Harden's never going to address this, at least until he gets to his next destination. But that will be the thing I'll be most fascinated about once that trade happens.
All right, you mentioned Steph Curry, and our new colleague, Michael Pena, his first piece up on SI.com was kind of a sort of overarching view of the future of Steph Curry. Steph's under contract through the end of next season, but as Pena pointed out, he has not signed an extension. There was some talk of a 3-year extension, about $150, $160 million to tack on to this deal. Steph has not expressed any kind of desire to play anywhere else. He's very comfortable in that situation. He's well taken care of, great building, you know, great coach and franchise and everything that is involved with them. But it's interesting. I mean, Steph is 32 years old. He's going to be 33 years old before the end of the season. That means the end of next season, he's going to be 34 years old. So you start to wonder, I mean, just how much do you want to commit to Steph Curry if you're the Golden State Warriors? Do you look at him and say, look, he's won us a couple of championships. He made us one of the franchises of the decade in from 2010 to 2020. Or, and he's entitled to whatever he wants. He wants to sign a max level contract at some point with us. We'll keep him on until he's 38, 39 years old. Or do you at some point get pragmatic if you're the Golden State Warriors and say, this guy's had a history of injuries. The ankle stuff hasn't flared up for a number of years, but that's still always kind of lurking out there in the back of our minds. What do you think, Howard? I mean, neither one of us is saying Steph Curry's on the trading block. And I certainly think if I'm spinning it forward, the Warriors are going to want to see what Klay Thompson looks like when he comes back and plays with Steph Curry. But it's interesting to think about just what kind of commitment you make to a smallish guard who is going to be 33, 34 years old when you eventually sign him to a new contract.
Yeah. So a couple of things come to mind. One is, because I'm still getting a feel for SI and policies, and Pena just got here. Like, can we expense disguises like Groucho Marx mustache? Because I don't know if Pena can go to the Bay Area now once travel is approved again, having floated the idea of trading Steph Curry. Like, that's pretty dire. It's either that or can we enroll? Like, is there a witness protection program we can enroll in? I think he might need that. I'm just concerned for Michael Pena.
We can discuss. I'll get back to you on that one. What we have.
It's a really good piece, and it's provocative on its face because it is just floating the idea of, is Steph Curry worth a massive contract into his late 30s, which is a crazy thing to think about. On multiple levels, right? He's beloved. He's beloved for good reason. He is one of the greatest, not just one of the greatest warriors ever. He's maybe the greatest warrior ever. He's one of the top Bay Area athletes of all time. Like, Steph Curry could, there is no mayor of the Bay Area, right? That's obviously three major cities there. He could run for mayor of any of those, Oakland, San Jose, San Francisco, or anywhere in between, and he'd win by like 99%. So the very thought of, like, is he worth X amount in his later years where it might be a real burden on the Warriors' payroll? Is he worth all the luxury tax payments in the meantime? Not just him, but this whole payroll. Because as Pena notes, you've got Draymond and his max deal, and you've got Wiggins' deal, and you've got Clay's deal, and eventually an extension for Wiseman. So, like, these are real issues, Chris. And that's the part of this that is not fanciful or, you know, somehow just provocative for the sake of being provocative. These are real issues. The Warriors ownership have been, you know, to their credit, under Lacob and Goober, have been really generous, whether it's regarding the luxury tax or funding their own new arena. They have never hesitated to spend to create a winner. And they believed, of course, that the Chase Center, their new arena, would be just a cash machine itself. And now there's a pandemic where they don't even have the benefit of that. So at some point, there may be a real reckoning here on the financial side. Like, can we afford to spend at this level if we're not contending anymore? Because that's what this is really about. Like, how long do you keep the franchise superstar in this Bay Area legend when it's no longer about winning championships? And it may come at a cost competitively and financially. So look, I don't think there's some imminent inflection point here where they have to make this call, but they did not extend him before this season. They'll have to discuss this again after this season and decide whether they want to. And, you know, where this all leads is, as Pena's very skillfully maps out, is if you decide you're not going to extend him, Do you then have to consider whether or not you might want to trade him before he hits free agency a couple of years down the road? I can't remember exactly which year it was, but next season. Those are real discussions. What's that?
After next season.
So in 2022, those are real discussions teams have to have. I don't know. What do you think? This is the sentimental side of me, not just being a Bay Area guy, but just in general, I tend to have a too big of a sentimental streak when it comes to sports. I like guys staying put. I like a team holding on to a legend. Like, I don't like I I I'm um allergic to the idea of the Warriors even parting with Steph Curry, given all he has meant there.
I think Golden State is in a strangely strong position when it comes to Steph Curry, because look, they have James Wiseman, and James Wiseman can play. We can debate what his ceiling is, but he is a starting level center in the NBA. I think he's going to be averaging double doubles as his career moves forward. I mean, how much better than that is he? You know, depends on how he evolves offensively. You know, does he wind up shooting better from mid range, three pointers, all that good stuff. They also have Minnesota's lightly protected first round pick next year. So they're kind of like in the early stages of a rebuilding process without having to go through it. They're like back channeling a rebuild with Wiseman and with this future number one pick in next year's draft, which, I mean, look, this is just what smarter people than I say, but they say next year's draft looks like it's loaded. This is a good draft going into next year. So you have the ability to have Wiseman and then another blue chip prospect at whatever position you choose as the foundation of your post Steph, Clay, Draymond, you know, group. What that means for Steph, in my mind, is that if you're Golden State, I wouldn't extend him. Like, I would play this whole thing out. I would go through this season and even into next summer and say, look, let's see what Clay looks like in the 21-22 season. Let's see what Draymond looks like. I mean, he's getting a little bit older as well. Is he still this all-defensive team defender, you know, a guy that can just do a whole bunch of things out there on the floor? How do they play with Wiseman? And go into that next season. Now, the risk you run is that Steph Curry hits free agency in 2022 and could walk away for nothing. But if you get to a point in the middle of the season where it's like, of that 21-22 season, where you're looking like, all right, we're not really a championship team, you could always trade Steph Curry at the deadline. You won't get the kind of return you would get by trading him now, but you could trade him if you wanted to at the deadline for something significant in return. So and look, if he hits free agency and he's playing great and all the pieces seem to fit, just give him the 5-year contract. Max him out. He's not going to turn that down. You're not going to turn out a 5-year max contract in that situation. In my mind, after my takeaway from reading Michael's piece was that, we're in kind of the era where you want to get these guys signed as long as possible, right? When Giannis, you got to get Giannis' name on the paper, or else you're going to be in a whole lot of trouble. It's almost the reverse in my mind for Golden State. You know, keep Steph under contract. You're paying a bunch of money for the next 2 years. And then at the end of, when he hits the end of that contract, reevaluate. You know, if he's playing at a high level, you know, roll the dice and say he's going to be able to play that way for 5 more years. If he's not, maybe you just walk away from him and build around Wiseman, whoever that number one pick is, and make that the foundation of your future. Is that crazy to think?
Not crazy. And there's a cold pragmatism there that, you know, look, the way you're framing it, that is, contrary to my sentimentality, the cold pragmatism is the way you have to go about it. Like, that's what Bob Myers and his staff and the ownership of the Warriors, that's the way they have to look at it. What's the best thing for the franchise going forward? Because there will someday be, whether it's in a year, 2, 5 years, there will be an end of the Steph Curry era, whenever it comes. You'd rather it be there, but you do need to do it in a way that doesn't hamstring you. One quick note, it may not just be the Timberwolves pick. It may be, if the Warriors are as bad as they've shown at times, I mean, we'll see where the season goes. It may be 2 top 5, top 8, top 10, whatever, in a strong draft. And if Wiseman blossoms into a star, still a little early for that, it's good indication so far. But yeah, they may have that rare ability to pull off the smoothish transition from championship era, dynasty era, to the next era without having to bottom out in a major way, or bottom out for too long. Like they kind of did bottom out in terms of record this past year, but weird circumstances with Clay out and all that stuff. But they might be able to thread that needle. It's really tough to do. But you want Curry there for it, if at all possible. The one thing I'll say, just in support of your framing, which is like, let him hit free agency. He'll be 34 at that time, right? And so how many teams, even if the fear were going to lose him in free agency, how many teams are going to go max out a 34-year-old especially a smaller guard who, you know, they don't generally age as well. Probably, yeah, there's probably not a lot of risk there. Unless, you know, say it's Charlotte who just wants to bring him home and, like, you know, have plant a flag or, you know, put a nice little, you know, flag in their cap or whatever. I don't think there's a lot of danger there. I guess the other danger, though, is more of, are you doing a disservice? Is it insulting in some way to Steph Curry to say, you know what, we're waiting for free agency. We just have to see where we are and how you look. Like, is that the wrong way to treat a guy who has meant that much to the franchise? Is it the wrong signal to send to other stars and their agents and their families? Because that is, there's a political reality too, Chris. You do have to factor in perceptions and just wanting to show that we're the kind of franchise that always takes care of its own.
I get that. Although, I mean, I would argue that writing him checks that total $45 million in that last season is thanks enough. I mean, it's
you and I know it's never that simple.
It isn't. You're right. It isn't. But worth watching. Good piece by Michael Pena. Check it out over at SI.com. It's up right now on the site. All right, let's talk a little bit about one of the more surprised teams in the NBA. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised by the play of the Phoenix Suns. Howard, they went 8-0 in the bubble, just missed out on a playoff appearance there. They have picked up right where they left off, started out 5-2 on this season. They're doing it with a top 10 offense, which isn't all that surprising because you add Chris Paul to that mix with Devin Booker and a few other guys. So you expect them to score, but they also have a top 5 defense with DeAndre Ayton anchoring that defensive unit. So I think we both kind of can agree that, you know, Phoenix has staying power as a playoff team, but what's the ceiling for a team like this? And what do you make of the early start of the Suns?
Nobody in their wildest dreams, probably not even Monty Williams, I don't think could have imagined as we record this, top 3 in defensive rating right now, behind the Sixers and the Cavaliers. So again, take things with a grain of salt early in this weird ass season. You know, in the midst of a pandemic, Cavaliers have the number 2 defense in the NBA, but the Suns are at 3. But this, I don't know if this, the Cavs are legit in that regard. I think the Suns are, though, Chris. You know, we know what Chris Paul brings. We know what kind of attitude, demeanor, and work ethic and edge that he brings. And, you know, you combine that with bringing in Jay Crowder, Ayton as a rim protector, Mikal Bridges, who's got great defensive abilities and switchability and range. Like, the pieces are there to this to be a legitimate top 10 defense for the season. Maybe they don't finish top 3, but top 10 seems reasonable. And when you consider the firepower they have with Devin Booker and Chris Paul and Bridges and Cam Johnson and Ayton, like, there's a nice spread of skill sets there. And I think the ability to win at a high level, we all thought they'd make the playoffs. I think everybody was on the Suns bandwagon for breakthroughs coming, lottery streak is over, pencil them in. And not as a 9th, 10th team that's going to play their way into the play-in tournament, but no, legit top 8 team. I thought the ceiling, Chris, was, yeah, it's, you know, 6-7. I now think it's top 4. And I never want to get carried away this early in a season, but I think they have a legitimate foundation there, and that this is not some fluke. This is not, like, you can see the outline of why this is working. And so I think it's legit. I think there are only 3 teams that are locks in the top 4. That's the Lakers and Clippers and the Nuggets, despite their record right now. Again, write it off. It's early in the season. I don't think there's anything permanently wrong with them. I think it's the LA teams in Denver that are in the top 3 for sure, which means the fourth team with home court advantage in the first round is either Portland, Utah, Dallas, Houston for the time being, maybe even post Harden trade, and Phoenix. So that's 5 teams, I think, that are legitimately in the mix for the fourth spot in the West. Do you think the Suns, Chris, can beat out those other teams I mentioned and be top 4?
I think they can, but to your point, it's all going to come down to just what kind of defensive team they remain. I mean, I don't expect them to be the 3rd best defensive team in the league for the entirety of the season, but can they stay inside that top 10? I mean, they've got the firepower. I mean, Chris Paul as much as I love Ricky Rubio, is an upgrade over Ricky Rubio. Devin Booker is, I mean, besides the massive amount of turnovers he's committing this early in the season, is playing good offensive basketball. Bridges is good. Cam Johnson is making shots for them this season. So they've got a lot of things going for them offensively. The key for me, and I agree with you that one of those top four spots is wide open. Like, I don't think there's a consensus number four in that mix. The key for me is Ayton. And I've been, I don't want to call it an Ayton hater. I haven't been a hater, but I've been a skeptic of Ayton over the years. Even going back to the bubble, like, there's just something about him sometimes where I don't know that his motor is going at all times. I don't trust his hands all the time, especially on offense when he's making some of those rim runs. He didn't keep his hands up all the time. Just little things that you notice watching a guy. But defensively this year, I mean, the guy has been an anchor for this team. You look at some of the stats that they've been putting together. As we speak, first in NBA opponents' points per game. Fourth, as you said, or third in defensive rating. Eighth in opponent e-field goal percentage. These are all great numbers. I think Ayton is playing a big part of it. He's rim protecting. He's playing decent on pick and roll defense. If that kind of play keeps up, and if Ayton gets it, keeps it out of his head that he has to be a 20, 25 point per game scorer, which I think is going to be key to this entire process, this team's got the ingredients. I mean, Ayton has all the physical tools to be a great defensive anchor. If he continues to be, I think that a top 4 or 5 seed is well within reach.
And you bring up an interesting question here because, you know, here we are, again, 7 games as we record this. He's averaging, you know, 13.7 points a game on just under 10 field goal attempts a game. He was at about 15 field goal attempts a game last season. So that's a pretty large decline. And he averaged 18 points a game last season. I don't know enough about Ayton's makeup to know whether that is an issue. It's not the same for everybody, for all young players. They're going to define themselves differently or value or you know, feel differently about themselves and their value to their team based on different factors. And maybe winning alone is going to keep everybody there, you know, happy with their roles. But if his role is going to be this diminished offensively throughout the season, how satisfied is he going to be with that trade-off? You know, he's a young player. Young players generally want to establish themselves first. They want to establish their value. They want to get to their second contract, you know, their first true max contract. And they'll have, you know, often, you know, friends and family around them who are saying, look, and you were the, you know, you're the number one overall pick. You can't be some fourth option on it. Like that, those things happen. And again, I'm not assuming anything on the part of Ayton and the messages he may be hearing from people close to him. But there is a history of that happening in this league. And so you hope those things don't get into his head. You hope that, certainly there's room for them to use him a little bit more offensively and for him to be more engaged offensively. And some of that has to be on him too, to just go get the ball. But, you know, I wouldn't flag that as a concern 7 games in. I would say it's something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. And I think some of that is going to be on Chris Paul to make sure Ayton is as involved offensively as he needs to be to keep him kind of invested in the other end of the floor. I mean, Chris is one of the smartest players in the league. He clearly recognizes the importance of Ayton on the defensive end. And if you have the ball in your hands as much as Chris does, you've got to find ways to get this guy easy opportunities, whether it's on more lobs or post touches, whatever it is, to make sure that he's getting just enough offensive play calling and just enough offensive touches to be happy being the defensive anchor he's been so far. I think for CP, that's going to be big on that end. So we'll see. Good start for Phoenix, though. Not all that surprising that they've been so good this quickly. Little bit surprising, though, as we move on to the next topic. The New York Knicks, as we record, Howard, 4-3. Break up the Knicks. What's going on in New York? No Obi wow. Toppin, but you've got Julius Randle playing like the MVP, 22 points per game. He's shooting 40% from three, which I never saw coming. Averaging a career high in rebounds, right around 11 and a half. You've got the rookie Quickly. Looking at his per 36 numbers, he'd be an all-star this year off those per 36 numbers. RJ Barrett still can't shoot, but he's putting up points, you know, getting to the rim and doing a lot of things offensively there. And you've got Tom Thibodeau doing what Tom Thibodeau does, like showcasing that while he is a horrible general manager, he really can coach. And he's got these guys playing disciplined defense. He's got them, you know, scoring enough to win. Thoughts on the Knicks' early start?
You know, if it weren't for the pandemic, Chris, there might already be a parade going through the Canyon of Champions. It's Knicks fans on my timeline are giddy, and I'm not going to begrudge them that giddiness for a second. As people have pointed out, they have a winning record in January for the first time in years. Never mind that the season just started 2 weeks ago, so it's not the same kind of January marker. But I actually went back. Forget the calendar. Do you know the last time they actually had a winning record after seven games? I found a couple years where they were 3-4 and then went to 4-4. But trying to find even a 4-3, the last time they were over 500, seven games into a season, was in 2012 when they started off 6-1. That was the 54-win season, which is by far the high water mark of the last 20 years. So I'm not projecting that. But I'm just saying it's been a long time since they've even had this much optimism for and justifiable optimism this early in a season. Julius Randle always had the talent, Chris. We know that. We saw it in LA. We saw it in New Orleans. But it was always, is he an empty stats guy? Is he too ball dominant? Is he, you know, too much of a black hole on offense? And he still has those moments. But I think he's been more efficient. He's been more patient. He's been a great playmaker for them. And I mean, 7.4 assists is nothing to laugh at. And if he can play that all kind of all around role for them as both scorer and distributor, there were times in the fourth quarter the other night where as soon as they got into the half court, the ball was in his hands. Like he wasn't necessarily always bringing it up, though at times he was, but he was acting as essentially the point forward. And he can do that. He's capable of that. You know, you never know what to make of a fast start from a guy like Quickly, you know, any rookies, but especially, you know, guys who were either drafted late or undrafted. You know, we see this every couple of years where somebody catches fire and you go, wow, did everybody just miss on this guy? And what do we make it? Again, not doubting any of it yet, but you know, you want to see a longer track record or bigger sample size just to be sure that they are tied for 10th overall in defensive efficiency. Seems about right for a Tom Thibodeau team. On the other hand, Tibbs never got the Timberwolves out of the bottom third in defense. So all the defensive acumen in the world and coaching in the world doesn't sometimes forge a bad or a good defensive team out of a bad one. So again, let's see where it's going. But I think at a minimum, what we've seen is that there's more structure here. The pieces seem to fit together better. There's just a feel like the Knicks go out there every night with a clear sense of what they're doing. And you couldn't always say that the last several years. Where it all leads, I don't know. I don't think they're a playoff team. I think most reasonable Knicks fans understand this is probably still not a playoff team this year, but that's not the point of the exercise right now, that we shouldn't judge them on that. I think the point of this season is see what you have in RJ Barrett. See if there's still something salvageable there in Kevin Knox. Find out what Mitch Robinson's ceiling is. See what you got in Obi Toppin once he gets healthy. See what you got in Quickly. You might have discovered a gem there. And then figure out what your core is. Because I think the three things to me that are the most positive possible outcomes of this season for them are you either are young and frisky and respectable, and now you're a more attractive destination for free agents, just like we saw the Nets do and like we saw the Clippers do, but the Knicks have not been that. So you either make yourself more of an appeal in free agency. You raise the trade value of the guys you got if you want to go that route. And you finally change the perceptions of you. If you can convince everybody that, you know what, this franchise is now in the right hands and we've got a coach and a front office that know what they're doing and young players with promise, you can change perceptions in this league very quickly.
Yeah, I don't think they're a playoff team either, but I do give them a shot at making the play-in tournament and maybe getting in that way. But to your point, like, they're a functional franchise. Like, they're doing the right things. They're having success, or at least a degree of success, this season, and it's not based off some absurd off-season move that made them slightly better in the short term. I mean, Julius Randle is on, I believe, an expiring contract from the year, the one he signed before. I don't think he's going to play like this all season long, especially not those shooting numbers, but I think he can be a solid scorer, rebounder. It's what he's been for most of his career. And you are building from the ground up. You're establishing a good base. Quickly looks like he's going to be part of your rotation. Where in that rotation remains to be seen. We haven't seen anything really from Obi Toppin yet, but he was widely regarded by a lot of people going into the draft as being one of the, you know, the better picks in and around that range. Mitchell Robinson, like, you want to talk about things that can that have staying power. Mitchell Robinson as a defensive stopper does. Like, Mitchell Robinson is a really, really good defensive player. I think he's going to be a terrific shot blocker, weak side defender in this league for many years to come. You put all that together, it's like, all right, maybe you finish the season, I don't know what the equivalent of, like, you know, 40 wins is in the shortened season, 30, 35 wins, and then you're onto something. You can draft somebody else in the lottery next year, and yeah, you can point to free agents and say, look, we're not, you know, the Bad News Bears anymore. We're not the gang that can't shoot straight. We're run by a front office that is showing it knows what it's doing. We have a head coach who, while he sure as hell is going to burn you out, I mean, R.J. Barrett and Randle are playing like the most, they're the top five in minutes, I think, in the league.
No, they're the top two in minutes in the entire league.
Top two.
They're literally just one and two.
That's vintage Tibbs. Like, just run these guys into the ground. Like, you may play a lot of minutes if you go there, but, you know, you give yourself a chance to win. Some of the quotes I've seen from some of the players, I think Randle said this recently, where it was, I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, it's like, you know, we trust the game plan. We know that we're going to go out there and be on kind of a level playing field. That's the kind of stuff you heard in Chicago a lot from guys like Jimmy Butler and others about, you know, coaching and working with Tom Thibodeau. So, look, even if they don't make the playoffs, they finish like ninth or 10th in the conference, but do it looking functional, that's a huge win for the Knicks. That is like
huge.
Cause for celebration if you're in New York, because it has been quite literally decades since they have looked like that.
Julius Randle, by the way, has a partial guarantee for next season, $4 million out of a $19.8 million deal, and they've got a, I think it fully guarantees late June. So if they, you know, at the moment, you know, there was a time when you probably thought you're going to let him walk and you'll eat the $4 million, or you're going to flip the contract because the partial guarantee means somebody else can get the cost savings. The way he's playing right now, I think you're more inclined to say, no, we'll just bring him back at 19.8, especially since the free agent class next summer has dwindled quite a bit. But who knows? I mean, that's an interesting potential quandary for them to have, and a good quandary. I think the only, if there's a gray lining to the silver lining, I don't know if that makes any damn sense, but if there is any downside to them being surprisingly competitive, it's that, as we alluded to earlier, this is supposed to be a phenomenal draft coming up, and what the Knicks really need still is a franchise star, a guy just to build around. You know, I don't think there's too many people around the league right now who think that RJ Barrett's going to be that guy. Like, he might be, you know, good to very good, but nobody's looking at him as like, okay, that's the guy you build around. And there's nobody else there, you know, unless Randle has suddenly become that guy. And this is a draft that's going to have some of those kinds of players. And so if there were ever a year where the Knicks should want to be bad, to be high in the lottery, this would be it. But look, I think you got to do whatever's best to get a friend. When you've gone through what they've been through, just get back on track. Show that you are respectable again and that you have a plan, that you know what you're doing, which is what they're doing right now. And I think that ultimately changing perceptions of you and lifting your profile within the league is, I don't want to say it's more valuable than, you know, drafting some stud in the lottery. That's a little naive, but it does have immense value. And if it gets you back into play in free agency, where guys still now look at you as a destination because you're in one of the greatest markets in the world, which has been squandered in recent years, that could fix a lot. So, you know, long way to go yet, but I don't think there's any bad outcomes here. Even if they regress, even if they miss the playoffs, fine. Great lottery draft class. You'd be high in the lottery. There's a good outcome for almost any path we can draw.
I mean, massively squandered the New York market in recent years. I mean, I think if you are functional and look like a team on the upswing, you will become a free agent destination once again. So hopefully for the Knicks' sake, they keep this up and are able to at least appear that way going into the next couple of summers. All right, let's finish, Howard, with Jaylen Brown. And I don't know if you put him in the most improved category, but he certainly has made some real big strides in the early part of this season. Averaged 20 points per game last season, as we record this, right around 27. His field goal percentage jumped almost 10 points from 48% to right around, or just a cut below, 58%. His three-point percentage up around 43% after shooting 38 last year. I mean, this is still kind of viewed as Jason Tatum's team. He's the guy at the top of the food chain, but Jaylen Brown's closing the gap on him right now. And I bring it up this up in the context of, you know, trade situations. I mean, we were talking at the top of the show about James Harden. How would he look in Boston? The Celtics are always the epicenter of trade rumors and have been over the recent years. But has Jaylen Brown almost become too big to trade? And we can use Harden as an example. Like, it sounds kind of goofy, but would you trade Jaylen Brown for James Harden at this point with the way Brown is playing and kind of the, you know, where this has been building towards over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, look, he's 24. He's not even really to his prime. It's like early prime, wherever, you know, whether they say prime is 27. So you're like pre-prime, early
prime. And on a good contract, too.
On a good contract. He's 24. I think you threw out the numbers already. He's averaging 27, 4.6 rebounds, 3 assists a game, shooting at a great percentage. He's a versatile and aggressive defender. He's a great two-way. I mean, he's one of the best two-way players in the league right now. And look, I look at the league, like, forget the hypothetical, you know, Jaylen for Harden thing, although it's a fun discussion if you love the who says no game. I look at where the league is, Chris, and I think, like, if you look at the last several champions or just the last 10 years or so, this league is so much controlled by versatile, long, athletic wing types, the Kevin Durants and Kawhi Leonards and LeBron Jameses and, excuse me, Jason Tatum. And Jaylen Brown falls into that. Like, maybe he's not at the same exact level as some of those, and I'm not even saying Jaylen and Jason belong with the Durant, Kawhi, LeBron tier. But those kind of players determine a lot about postseason success. And if you've got a guy who is in that, you know, 6'7", 6'8", 6'9", range, who's long, who can handle, who can shoot, who can defend multiple positions, who you can run offense through, I just think that's where the league is right now. And the Celtics have different levels of it, but they have two of them. They have two of them. As a broad outline, that's what I'd want to build around. And so, you know, I don't know how seriously, I mean, you're up that way, so I don't know if that discussion, how much that percolates around. I can't imagine there's any serious discussions of, like, flipping Jaylen Brown for some other piece. I would rather have those two together for 10 years and see what I can get out of it and build around them than probably any number of other possibilities. Now, if you start getting to hypothetical after hypothetical, well, what about this guy? What about that? I mean, I'm sure we'd find a scenario where I would flip Jaylen Brown. But right now, I love the potential of those two together. So I don't think I'd trade him for too many players, if at all.
I can't think of one at this point that I trade him for. And it, to what you were saying, it has as much to do as with the Celtics situation as it has for Jaylen Brown. Like, the Celtics are not in the same situation a team like Portland is or Toronto is, where you have star players that are, you know, in the back half of their prime or even later in their careers. I mean, Jaylen Brown is 24. Jason Tatum is 22. And I know, crazy, you know, it's you know, fans and people get tired of saying, well, play the long game, the Celtics, all their draft picks, all that stuff that has been bandied about in recent years. But it's true. I mean, these guys are both signed to long-term contracts that'll keep them together for, I believe, at least the next 4 years, if not longer after that. And, you know, I think Tatum, and I've said this before, in the coming months and years, is going to develop into an MVP candidate. I think his offensive game is that special, and defensively he improves every single year. I think Jaylen Brown can be kind of the perfect Scottie Pippen-like complement to, you know, Jason Tatum's proverbial Michael Jordan. Like, he came into this league as a better defensive player than he was offensive player. He was a slasher. He defended, didn't have an outside shot. He has worked. The guy works every single year. And you look at the numbers, you throw up that woebegone second season when everything went wrong in Boston, or third season for Brown, when everything went wrong in Boston. And he has improved in almost every statistical category every single year. I expect those improvements to continue. I expect him to be around 38 to 40% from three over the course of this season. I expect him to be a candidate for an all-defensive team during the season. I expect him to be and even all-star this season. So when you have two guys like that, you know, maybe you don't win a championship with them, you know, in this year, but in the years to come, you're guaranteed to have that. Whereas how many other teams are guaranteed to have some combination of two players on that level? So I don't know. I certainly wouldn't do it for Harden. Like, the Celtics are not in the position where James Harden is such an upgrade over Jaylen Brown that you make the deal and risk potentially blowing, you know, the next 10 years of your franchise. I don't know who else is out there on the market that is, you know, considered a trade chip in a situation like that. So I think, you know, Jaylen Brown to me has become too big to trade at this point. Jason Tatum already was. Jaylen Brown, after being, you know, the guy you trade for Kawhi, the guy you trade for Anthony Davis, at this point, Jaylen Brown, too big to deal.
Well, I mean, look, if not that it would be, but if we're doing the hypotheticals, if it were Jaylen Brown for Anthony Davis tomorrow and you could pair Anthony Davis with Jason Tatum, you'd probably do it. But, you know, that's not a realistic discussion. One other wrinkle to this one, coincidental to this podcast agenda, because I didn't know when I had this conversation a couple of days ago that we would be discussing Jaylen Brown today. But I had back and forth with a friend who's a Sixer fan, and we were just talking about Simmons and Embiid and all this, and he was saying, as a Sixer fan, you know, I wonder if you had to do over again in that draft, because it went Simmons, Ingram, Brown, would Simmons still be number one? I thought, whoa, wait, hold on. And so your initial reaction is to always think, like, that's crazy. Of course, Ben Simmons, he's a unicorn, 6'10", point guard, da-da-da, all this. But I started thinking about it. You know, obviously Ingram's become an all-star and Jaylen Brown's on his way there. And when you think about two-way skill sets and just the offensive repertoire that the other two guys have that Ben Simmons does not have at this stage. And so out of curiosity, I threw this at a scout who has seen plenty of all these guys. And he did, like, I was expecting the get the hell out of here with that question response. And it was not. It was, you know, I think I would take Jaylen Brown. Like, that was literally the response. Was I threw out just, what do you think? You know, going back, doing the redraft thing, Simmons, Brown, Ingram, is it fair to think that the other two could potentially leapfrog him? And I was very cautious about it because, again, I didn't want, like, it. You get to a certain point where things are so well established in the way that we view these players, sometimes it feels like heresy, and especially because Ben Simmons is such a unique player, but he has limitations. And yeah, this scout came back with, I would take Jaylen Brown over Ben Simmons.
If nothing else,
because of all of that offensive repertoire.
If nothing else, the gap is closed considerably amongst all three, where it's almost interchangeable, or getting to that point where it's interchangeable at this point. But yeah, I mean, you know, Jaylen Brown turned out to be a lot better than I think a lot of people expected him to be over the last couple of years. Howard, always great to talk to you, man. We'll catch up this time next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.